Got to get my name tag on. You know. Happy Patty's Day, you know. It reminded me as I was getting ready for this that, you know, I used to have a second name tag, you know, for my office name tag, you know, that had O. Hilsenbeck, you know. So I was always Irish for at least one day, you know. My name's John Hilsenbeck. And I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Very, very grateful one today. My last drink was October 22nd, 1991. And I want to recognize, if I can, a few special people here today, if we have them in the room. Because over the last couple of weeks, going over this, I've had a lot of stir of emotions and, you know, and scanning my past. And is there anybody in the room today that has right at 6 months or less?
Less.
I'm really glad you're here, both of you. Yeah. Welcome, welcome. Is there anybody that has right around 30 days or less? Welcome. Anybody has got within 2 weeks? 2 weeks, around 2 weeks. You're the most special person in this room, buddy. I hope you keep coming back. I am an alcoholic. I'm addicted to alcohol, but I'm addicted to a lot of other things too, you know, and I'm not going to go into all those things, you know. They come in their own time, in their own way, you know, but I am an alcoholic. I'm really addicted to more, you know, in life, in every way, shape, or form, and more ego inflation, more ego stroking, more self-centric behavior, all of those things, and alcohol was the magic elixir, the turbo fuel, you know, for me to run through life on my own willpower without much regard for other people that were in my path. I want to tell a quick story, if I can, about, it's going to be kind of going fast forward into 1991, you know, October. I was 2 months sober. It was in my first 2 months. I'd been slipping and sliding for about 2 months, and I had a sponsor at this point, and I was meeting with him down at the Brown Seal, which is the end of First Street. It's now Bella Sienna's, but all sponsors and sponsees met there, you know, all the time. And we met every lunch hour, you know, during that time. I unloaded all my woes, and I had a lot of them. You know, my whole world was crashing every day in a new way, and the hurricane was taking over my mind, and I mean, everything was falling apart, and nothing was going right, and he'd hear me out, and then eventually he had to get back to work, you know, because he had a real job, you know, that he went to, and we were leaving the Brown Seal and crossing the street right in front of what was then, it was actually grand opening day for Captain Blythers, okay, it's now Sailor Jack's, and We were walking across in front of it, and I looked over, and in the window was this waitress. You know, she's standing on a chair, you know, short skirt, and looking straight at me. I mean, we were like, whoa. I mean, you know, my heart skipped a beat, you know, and I mean, it was undeniable that she was looking straight at me, and she had that look, you know, that I'd seen a bunch of times before, you know, that one that it was usually actually underneath that disco ball, you know, that had all the, you know, and across the room about 150 people, you know, and maybe right, you know, 1:45 in the morning, you know, when nobody wanted to go home alone, you know, and our eyes were locking, you know, and I said, Tom, you know, he was in front, I'd slowed down and he kind of got in front of me, and I said, Tom, look, I think she's noticing me, you know, like that. And I can't tell you, coming after we've been talking, how empty I was because of all I'd shared. And that happened every lunch, every day, you know, and it just got me to the next meeting that night, you know, where I could get refueled. But in that moment, you know, I was completely void of anything. You know, I was so weak and vulnerable, and but I was calling to him. I said, I think she's noticing. She's noticing me. You know, and just as he turned around, you know, and looked over there and saw what I was looking at, her hand came up from her side with that newspaper and smacked that fly on the window. You know, and I was crushed. I mean, this was all in milliseconds. I mean, my heart hit the ground. And I looked up, and he was already laughing. And I looked at him, and I started laughing. And I had never laughed that hard in my life. I was crying before we were over in laughter. And I came to realize right then and there, you know, that there was something to this program that I had no idea was going on. Because no longer did I, you know, check out with a mind-altering substance, but I was living life here on life's terms, and my ego had just been smashed, you know, and I knew the solution was the opposite of that, you know. I didn't want, you know, granted, it didn't feel good at all. I mean, it was terrible, but in that moment, I knew there was something more for me, you know, if I just stuck around. And I did for about 72 days. You know, I was going to I just threw myself into the program. I was doing all the service I could. I was going 2 to 3 meetings a day. I think I did that for the first 5 months I was in here. But at the end of that, you know, that one decision, you know, of that one element of doubt, that one seed of doubt that makes that one decision possible, I decided this one morning I was supposed to go to a meeting that night. It was Tuesday night. I was supposed to go over to the Church of Christ on N Street. That morning, I had got a big old bottle of E&J, you know, and I picked up the phone because my sponsor told me, you know, don't drink unless you call me first, you know. And so I called him, and we didn't have cell phones then. I knew I wasn't going to get him, you know. He was at work. He was another regular guy working, you know. So I left his message full of, you know, the works, you know. Well, you told me to call you, you know, blah, 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 you know, and I hung up and I proceeded to drink for about 12 hours straight, pass out, come to all day long. Somebody was supposed to pick me up that night to take me to the meeting. I, to this day, and he's sitting in this room right now, don't know if he even came to my house. I've never desired to ask, but I came to in enough time to get my wits about me to remember that I was supposed to be at that meeting, and I went. And I sat, instead of the back, which I always did, I sat right at the front, up at the speaker. And it wasn't vodka I drank, so, you know, I mean, I was reeking. I had no doubt in my mind I was reeking, you know. But not a single person, I didn't leave there with any inkling that that wasn't the right place for me, you know. I mean, granted, I probably didn't tear the place down, you know, but at the same time, and I never forgot that part. I will now tell a little bit about my background. I was born in St. Louis, South St. Louis in 1952, and my mom and dad were together for over 50 years. Had an older brother, 5 years older than me, and a sister, she's 3 years older than I am. We were poor, and you know, and my mom spent a lot of time in church and community service, and at home she was explosive and volatile, and both emotionally and physically to all of us. And I just mention that as a little bit of background to my story, because I'll talk about my dad too, which plays even to me an even bigger part. He drank beer. She didn't drink much at all, and not at all. And my dad drank beer, and he drank a lot of it sometimes. He never got to the point where he declared or anything like that. But his father died when he was 3 years old. He was a town drunk in northern Missouri, And his mom died when he was 14. And my dad was there, but he was not there. He worked. I think partly because it was such a volatile environment, but also because his work, you know, was at a plant, and it was long days, and he was very passive, you know, towards my mom, and he would actually take the brunt of the explosions a lot, you know, and that I got to witness we were in a flat where there was no place to hide. You know, I mean, there was no bedrooms, you know, until I was 8 years old. So the only place I learned to hide was right up here, you know, inside, you know. And he was critical. I mean, he was very critical. I mean, he would refer to me in derogatory terms, you know, if I made a mistake. At first, you know, I took that on myself, you know, and I'd hear his voice and in my mind's voice as I was growing up, you know, doing the same thing. And then that voice faded away, and it was from then on, it was my own voice, you know, saying those things to me. And anybody out on the golf course knows how that voice sounds coming out of my mouth, you know, when I make a few bad shots, you know. Thankfully, that's not the case so much anymore. My brother, he's, like I said, he's 5 years older than I was. He was my mentor, you know, and really kind of in many ways my father. I looked to him that way. And he introduced me to drugs, you know, at first. My first foray into that was actually an hallucinogen, you know, when I got the duty of putting away the guitar back into the case. It's amazing how much of that mescaline dust still on the guitar, back of the guitar, you know, as I was wiping it off and cleaning it off. And, you know, and I came to the next night, you know, came back down the next night, you know. And during that time, I saw the face of Christ, and it wasn't pretty. You know, it was a bad trip, you know, but hey, you know, I mean, I learned that that's, you do those things because that's, you don't want to be the way you are, you know, and I like that, you know, in a weird kind of way. And my first drunk was not long after that. I was 12 years old. My friend bet me a nickel, and that's back when a nickel was a nickel. But he bet me a nickel that I wouldn't drink, you know, two fingers of his dad's bourbon out of the cabinet. And of course I chugged that down. I love the feeling of it going down, you know, slow and warm. And then I taunted him into betting me another nickel, you know, and I had that second one, and I barely got home. I was on my bike, and I mean, I just kept on running into the curb, you know, every time I'd get on it and stuff like that. And it was only about a mile away. If I finally got home, I don't know how I got to bed without being discovered, but I did. And that was really the beginning of my drinking. I mean, I really do consider that it wasn't long after that that I crossed the line into alcoholism, you know, not because I had it all the time, and certainly alcohol wasn't available all the time, but drugs were, you know, I mean, different types of alcohol. And I would get it whenever I could. And my life started changing immediately because I became a seeker, you know, I mean, a constant seeker. You know, my friends started changing. My brother had been a runner in high school, and a pretty good one, you know. And so 5 years back, you know, I'm still in middle school, and he's running, you know, doing well. And so I'm starting to run, you know. I'm getting ready, and I'm running some long distances and all this, and having fun. And there's that part of me that really was devoted in baseball. I played baseball. I bowled. You know, I did a lot of stuff, and I did them well because I was always looking for my dad's approval, you know, with those kind of things, because a few of those were things he did, you know, and so seeking a little bit of approval with that. And so I was very into that, but that change started happening, you know, and it was slow at first. You know, there's only so much time, you know, and so much you can mix together. And the girls, you know, they came around, you know, I mean, that part of me, you know, was distracted with that too. But I truly started that journey right around 13 years old. So that's a really important thing for me to remember. I've often described myself, and I still do, as a Ritalin kid without Ritalin. You know, I ricocheted through life, you know, off of life with ever increasing consequences. I was always on the go. I mean, I remember, and I don't think I make this up, but I remember doing stuff in diapers, you know, that was bizarre, you know, and just going and off the property and doing stuff, stealing, you know, running into stuff, stitches, broken bones, you know, and it just didn't matter. I was always on the go, and that carried all the way through most of my life. I think of myself as quite cavalier and irresponsible as the youngest child in that family. So I mean that's what continued all the way through high school. I gradually stopped sports right around my sophomore year, and it was full-time drugs and alcohol, and I barely got out of high school. I mean, it came down to my last government class. I had to get a D in it, and that's what I got. You have to get out. I mean, it takes a lot of work to get out with a 1.8 in high school. You know, I actually went back years later and checked that, and it was 1.8. You know, so, needless to say, I was ill prepared with that. I was ill prepared as far as life skills, you know, to take with me, because my dad, you know, I don't think he had it, but he certainly didn't pass it on much either. Too, in my junior year, senior year, during that winter, my girlfriend at the time, who we were also in the church youth group, got pregnant, and so we're seniors and we got married, and all of a sudden, this Ritalin kid without Ritalin, you know, ran headfirst into life. I mean, it just like in a big way. I suffered some severe breakdowns, you know, emotionally, spiritually, physically. I mean, I was choking on food. I was having psychotic episodes. I was on Librium and Valium trying to treat that. I was in my dad's workplace for about a year. That was one job I had for about a year, in which we'd built these four-count accelerometers that were for Navy planes to decide when they'd come in for service, you know, that it would measure the stresses and this and that. And I was falling face forward on the assembly line, you know, from all that, you know. But during that time, and as a young couple, you know, every chance I got, I would drink. You know, I'd use. I mean, that was a constant thing. And finally, I did, and the part of me that was so still connected to my parents and my family and wanting to get their approval kept me from just going off the deep end and just bailing at that time and off on my own, because I was really terrified of what that would lead to, I'll be honest with you. And so I decided to... It was an act of desperation that I decided I was going to go back to college. I was going to get a degree. You know, I'd actually worked for Standard Oil, which was Chevron now, but it was Standard Oil back then. And I saw these batch balance. I was a batch balance tray picker upper, you know, and that's all I could. That's all I was good for, you know. And I was picking these trays up, you know, and I got to see a lot. I got to see the Standard Oiler, which was all. The company little news thing each month comes out, and I got to know the people that were retiring, and they were all drunks and losers, you know, but they still, I knew that they'd done well. And I saw people close to my age that had done well, and they all had degrees, and I knew I just absolutely had to have one. You know, that was the only, because I was nothing. I felt worthless as a human being in this relationship, as a father, as a husband. And that was the only thing I could think of doing. And I took every ounce of my alcoholic energy and put into that. Jumped in as an accounting major at DVC and completely flunked out that first semester. Absolutely died. And I went home devastated. Now, what was for about a week? I mean, I was just absolutely at the worst point of my life. And I was either going to have to quit and figure out something else or do what I did. And that was redouble my efforts. And I took the same load the next time, and I added remedial stuff that counted nothing towards any degree but reading, how to read, how to take notes, how to write, how to, you know, and you can't learn that in a semester. I mean, but at least it gave me a start. And I was working. I started working at Kaiser Permanente, evenings and nights, short hour and on call. And those two things came together, and I went to school full time, and I was out. I mean, I was actually in many ways where I wanted to be, which was I wasn't qualified to be a family, a father, or a husband, but now I was a student. I was that guy, you know, that was working his ass off for his family, you know, and doing all that. And I got through. I actually got a bachelor's degree in business in 3.5 years. With that, I mean, that's how hard I worked. I would schedule my days in 15-minute increments, you know, in order to get that done. But every chance, every weekend, every time we got, we were playing games like, I don't know if you remember a board game called Pass Out. Guess what the objective is? Yeah. it's the last one not to pass out. But I, you know, I lost that all the time. You know, I mean, that's just what I did. I mean, I other than alcohol, you know, I gravitated towards uppers. But there wasn't a single thing that I ever turned down. I never turned down a thing that was offered to me. So I'm just saying that because we cross over all the time, you know. But I do understand that alcohol is my problem. And so I got through college, you know. I worked hard. She was the mother of my daughter and raised her, worked full time, raised her, managed everything in my absence, and you know. And then I got done, and that night we had a celebration. There was a bunch of people there, and one of my guys I went to school with, you know, he'd brought some flowers for his wife, and you know. And on the way home, she just casually mentioned, well, it would have been nice if you would have brought some flowers, you know, like that. And I was so indignant that within a day, I decided I was going to leave that family, you know, because the night was mine. You know, I'd worked hard. And that's the alcoholic right here standing in front of you back then, you know. And so I went on and I partied hard. I was working with Kaiser. My whole career is Kaiser. You know, from 1971 to 2010, when I retired, I was a Kaiser employee of some sort. You know, I continued in Walnut Creek when I was working there, and we would party at night up on the fourth floor of the surgery building, out on the ledge. You know, we'd be either drinking after all our work was done, after all our homework was done, when we were going to school. You know, we'd be out there on the ledge looking at the skyscraper, and you know, and partying and having fun. And so there's ample places to party along the way, if that's your thing. And it definitely was my thing. When I transferred over to Northern California region in management engineering, I had an option to either be a junior financial analyst or an industrial engineering or management engineering technician, which, of course, junior financial analyst is right in my wheelhouse, but it would keep me in the office right there, you know. And I didn't see that as a way to drink. So I took in management engineering so I'd be able to travel around, and I was a fish in water in the medical center and drank like a fish when I wasn't, you know. But that was my thinking. So I ended up spending that, you know, 15 years in that department swimming upstream. I mean, it wasn't in my wheel. I mean, it was like, that's the kind of decisions I, you know, in spite of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, I would continue to make decisions that were not in my best interest. You know, that really summarizes a lot of my thinking along the way. You know, when I was drinking and drugging, it just ruled my life. And that went on and until about 1989, I was working on a project in the Oakland Medical Center. Is a big one. I was overseeing. We were observing nurses, you know, in their duties, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for about a month. And I was hiring temps, you know, and it was a particularly low unemployment. So the temps I got were unemployed for a reason. I mean, they didn't have a job, you know, in many cases. And it was also in October in 89, it was, you know, I went over to a baseball game in San Francisco, and it was a World Series game, and we had an earthquake, you know. And I was tailgating at the time in the parking lot, and I just come out of the outhouse, I mean the porta potty there. I just got done and opened the door, and it hit, and I kind of steadied myself. You know, I didn't realize it was an earthquake at the time. I just thought I'd part of my drinking, you know. And no, honestly, I didn't. And you know, I just spread them out, you know, so I could get my feet under me. And then there's a whoop and a holler going up throughout the entire parking lot, because everybody thought it was an omen. They were on our turf. I mean, there was no thoughts about an earthquake. And I was right in there, and that's alcoholic thinking for you. I mean, you're so unpresent, unaware of anything, that you think that somehow in that second that it was an omen, you know. And Needless to say, it wasn't. And working in that Oakland Medical Center, I got to see a lot, you know, from Cyprus, you know, the people coming in injured and all that. But more than that, managing those people or mismanaging those people I was in charge of. And I was a terrible employee. I really was. In many respects, I was, because I neglected my duties often in those positions. And I did in that case. And I had to hire and fire, and because I wasn't doing my job properly, I would let people go that really didn't deserve to be go, you know. But I needed to either save face or something like that. And bottom line around that is that I had this overwhelming sense, and I think the gravity of it was intensified because of the magnitude of the earthquake and the shock to everybody's system that. And mine in particular at the time, about how life is so fleeting, you know, that I came to realize that I was really inflicting a lot of moral injury on myself at the time, you know, by doing the kinds of things, knowingly doing the kinds of things I was doing, you know, to them and then eventually to myself. And I started talking to my friends about, when I'd drink with them in the year following this all happened, about that kind of thing. And so the conversation started drifting into a lot of morbid reflection in, you know, my day, letting them know, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be drinking all that much longer, you know, and things. So my drinking crowd started shrinking a bit that way, you know, because there's not a lot of people that want to carry that conversation on for very long, even my closest friends. But that went on through the year 1990. So I ended up getting into the first meeting I came to, and I should say that my sister came in a couple years before I did, and I started noticing, I didn't really know what she was doing, but I did sense that there were some changes going on with her, you know. We used to run pretty hard and do some partying, but I didn't ask her what those changes were, because I didn't want to know the answer, really, you know. But I did notice some changes, and the words coming out of her mouth were different. And, but I tell you, you know, knowing that kind of made it seem possible that I might be able to do something. And I picked up that phone, in May of 91, and I called the central office and they answered the phone, and I hung up because I was afraid they'd trace the call, you know, But I knew it was up. I mean, I knew it was up. And I did go to a meeting that night over at Vallejo Fellowship. And don't remember much about that first meeting, but I did go home and finish the bottle I had and came back to another meeting. It was a Saturday. I think they had two meetings there. And came back to the second one. Don't remember a whole lot about that one either. I mean, I remember a couple. I remember how steep that ramp was going down on Virginia Street. You know, it was, gee, Christ. You know, coming off the street. I mean, it was like, for a scared person going into a room like that, it was pretty intimidating. It seemed pretty intimidating. And then I started wondering if this little town, adjacent town I was living in Vallejo at the time, Benicia, you know, if they had any meetings. So I just decided to look those up, and I started going to a few over there. And, you know, I didn't have a problem with the unmanageability of this program at all. I mean, maybe you can kind of sense from my life and everything that went on that, you know, I actually equated unmanageability with insanity, you know, when I first came here, you know. I mean, I thought is an unmanageable thing. I didn't think I was ever sane in my life. I mean, I actually used to tell friends of mine, I said, man, I think I'm going insane. John, you're the most sane person I know, you know, and I'd never believe them. I figured they must be insane, you know, so it's two of us, you know, but that's the way I felt, you know, and I didn't have any trouble with the unmanageability piece of it, but the power part I did. I mean, because all the stuff I did, you know, my life was on sheer willpower. I mean, I had a chin of granite. You know, if I could, and I wasn't smart through college at all. But I mean, I I put the time in. I figured out the systems. I figured out the ways to get it done, you know, and I did. I just couldn't give that up for a while. But I heard you guys talking about stuff, about the very same things that I had struggled with, you know, and that I was having trouble with. And I said, okay, you know, I'm going to give this a chance. I mean, I'll let it go, you know, because it clearly wasn't working, you know, hadn't been working for a long time. And like I said, in that last year, it was going down, you know, and I mean, I knew it was going down, and I'd given up a big part of me way back in at the earthquake. A big piece of me had surrendered there, but you know, not enough to really make a difference in my lifestyle. So I mentioned I'd been slipping and sliding for about 2 months, and that really amounted to three days sober, 2 days drunk, you know, 5 days sober, 3 days drunk, you know, out like that, on and on. I felt like a bit like a pincushion or one of those clowns, you know, that you knock down and bounces back up. Because I knew this is where it was for me. I knew that this is where it was. I mean, it didn't take long for me to hear that, what I know now is the language of the heart, you know, from you guys. And it's like you guys had read my mail, you know, and because you were talking my story, not exactly, but so close. And it was unlike anything I'd ever heard before. But that last stretch after 2.5 months, I took that drink and I went out and went to that Church of Christ meeting. It wasn't the actual drunk that really, really got me. It was the morning after. You know, when I had come to that next morning, as I was coming to, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Four horsemen absolutely trampled me into dust. You know, what I'd given up, what I felt at what I'd given up, and I even had thoughts about, wow, man, maybe you're one of the constitutionally incapable people, you know. I don't ever want to forget that, and I don't. Threw myself back into meetings, and I went the very next day, which is Wednesday, to the men's meeting, and I continue to go to the men's meeting to even today. But that sanity piece I was telling you about, I could see that very shortly that I, you know, I was starting to have a clearer mind, you know, and starting to have money in my bank account, you know, and all those things, you know, that come with being sober. And the shutoff notices on my door were starting to go away, you know, that I had every month. And it was, you know, and it was about 2 months in that something really, really special happened to me that I could have never planned. But in spite of the questionable type of employee I was, I had an assignment with this other guy to go to Ohio. And we went to Ohio, and there's somebody in this program, knew somebody back there that was in the program, and he fancied himself to be a historian. He's had about 15 years sober, and he agreed to meet up with me and take me around Akron and, you know, and show me all the places there on a Saturday. So I was there 2 weeks. So the following Saturday, the first Saturday I was there. And I came, I woke up that morning. It was such a bad week on top of bad weeks, you know. But particularly, I woke up that morning, and the first thing I was aware of is that I had tears coming down my cheeks. His name was Bob, and he took me for about 8 hours in this van to Everything Was Anything in Akron, Ohio. And we started at Dr. Bob's house, and there was three of us before it opened there, and we were standing outside, and he, not talking to each other, we were kind of in a little space, you know, in early morning, and door opened, and we went in Dr. Bob's house, and within 5 minutes, we were having people take our pictures like we'd known each other for 40 years. I mean, it was just unbelievable how joyful that was in such a short period of time. And we ended up at Dr. Bob's grave, and we went to every place in between, the Mayflower, the bridge where he went and retrieved drunk lunch during his lunch hour. Went to Cyberlink States, went to, we went everywhere. And then at the end, after a long day, a lot of tears, we were at Dr. Bob's grave, and I was just standing looking down, and I mean, just couldn't stop. I had my hand up on his headstone, and through all that, I saw this hand reach across his grave, and I looked up, and there's this guy who had probably done this 50 times, you know, with people, you know, taking them around and stuff like that, and had all the sobriety and stuff, and he was crying harder than I was. And he said, "Would you close this meeting with me?" And we held hands across there and finished the circle. He had his hand on headstone too and said the serenity prayer. And my life was changed again. It took me a few months after that to do my first four step. It was 9 months, and I was out at Dan Foley Park. And I had the binder, I had a lot of paper, I had a lunch, I had drinks. It was a beautiful day. I was going to write the world's greatest novel. And 2 hours after I sat there, I still had a blank page in front of me, you know. And I had such a prideful, steeped, part of it was that, but part of it was actually some psychological blocking that I came to realize later in my recovery, but that I couldn't get to it, you know. I mean, I had this thing that I wasn't that, still wasn't quite all that bad, you know. That I was forcing a few things down, but I wasn't getting down to, and I desperately wanted to, I honestly did. I was like white knuckling the pencil, you know, trying to get it on paper, and it just wasn't coming. What helped me was actually a couple of years later, I did a fears inventory, you know, and the reason that made sense to me, as soon as I thought of it, it made sense, because it's the corrosive thread, you know, that's through the fabric of everything, and it was vertical, you know, not horizontal. That's the way I looked at it. You know, if I started identifying those triggers, you know, that were from fear, you know, when something come up, I would be triggered. I'd react maybe, you know, as a child reacts, you know, to something, write it down. Those are the things, and I could go straight down through everything. And I had 9.5 pages of stuff when I was done. I was just flabbergasted how much stuff came out. And then I shared it with another member of this program. Thank you, Elwin, for that time. Meant a great deal and helped me so much. And 6 and 7, you know, might be my favorite steps. I call 6 the step that keeps on giving. You know, first time I touched on 7, I thought it was a freebie, you know, because it didn't ask me to do nothing. It was the only one that doesn't ask me to do anything. You know, it's a self-assessment. You know, I can do that. Sure, I'm ready. Sure, okay, fine. Move on. And I got exactly what I deserved with that, you know. I mean, I ran into all kinds of, I'd already done 5, you know, so I had stuff up in my head, you know, and on my heart, you know, and really hadn't done anything to take care of it. And 6 calls for humility, and I clearly didn't have enough of that. You know, and so it was actually life circumstances that caused me to do that correctly, and I was in danger of losing someone that I'd loved deeply at that time, and it took me to a place where I had to literally call out to God, you know, take her if you need her, you know, she's not mine, kind of thing, and then that became take anything, take everything, you know, and I didn't bargain for what it took, you know, because it took things I wasn't ready to give up, but it just showed me how sincere I was with the whole deal. I mean, it took things that I thought were neutral at worst, but pleasurable, you know, at best. I mean, my golfing, my running, my guitar playing, you know, my golfing, I'd go out to the golf course and the clubs would feel like they're 50 pounds. you know, when I'd swing at it, you know, and I walked off, I would walk off a course after the third hole without saying anything to anybody. I'd get up to and tie my shoes to run, go out to run, and I had lead in my feet, you know. And I'd turn around and go back home. I'd pick up the guitar and it was never in tune, even though I'd tuned it the day before. You know, it took them all away. And I don't think I ever thought that it truly would take them for good, you know, but I was ready. You know, I mean, I said, if it does, I'll figure, something else will come. I'll do it. I'll figure it out, you know. I was ready. I did, you know. And I just absolutely love that step because, you know, leading up to it, if I haven't got, I mean, everything's about humility leading up to that. And it really calls for humility from a humble place to do that. And if it doesn't, then, and if I haven't got it, you know, it's just not going to happen. So in step 8 and 9, I most of that was work related, and then of course relationship related, a lot of relationship stuff. But in work, I had a lot to work on there. And fortunately, I had almost as much time with Kaiser sober as I did drinking, you know. So it was kind of, it worked out that way, you know. It was kind of fun. I'm not a big person for journaling. I never have been, you know. But I do spot check inventories, you know, and I always have. And I pause and I reflect, you know, and I contemplate, you know. And I believe in step 11 that it's for me, prayer and the meditation go hand in hand with that. I mean, it's not by mistake that it's included in those steps. And I think for me, prayer is like the perfect preface for a meditation and contemplative mind, because I'm ready, I'm in the right mood, you know, to receive whatever comes in. And I happen to be a real lover of the St. Francis prayer, you know, or peace prayer, however you want to call it. In 12, in my spiritual awakening, I sponsored a lot more people in my early sobriety than I do today. Not because I don't want to, but because it just doesn't happen. And I mean, I am, people I know that I'm available at any time anyway. And I mean, so I don't go seeking them. That may change in the future. You know, I've seen changes over the years, you know, of sometimes there's an ebb and sometimes there's a flow, and sometimes whether it be going to meetings a lot or not, you know, or things come up, and I'm definitely available for that. I love the men's retreats. They've meant a great deal to me. I was thinking about it the other day, between the spring retreat and the fall retreat, I've probably done 45 retreats, you know, and I try not to miss a single one. Because it changes lives, you know, changes my life every time I go, and I've seen lives change. Somebody said that it's like going to a year's worth of meetings in one weekend for the number of hours we fellowship and meet together. And that's powerful. That is so powerful. You know, and it taught me how to be, you know, not only a friend among friends, you know, in the men's groups, but it's taught me how to be a man among men, how to grow up. You know, when I crossed the line in alcoholism, when I was 13, I stopped growing emotionally, you know. And when I got here in 1991, I was 39 going on 13 emotionally. And I've grown up. Everything I know as a recovered adult, I've learned here as a functional adult. I've learned here. I've grown up. You know, when I came to that first meeting without a drink and got through that first day, I laid a stone to walk on, you know, in my emotional maturation. You know, and every time I come across adversity or success for that matter, and not have to change my feelings around it or just experience it, I grew emotionally from that. And I continue to do that. I've done that for a long time, and I'm happy to declare myself an adult today, you know, a sober, recovered adult. Right now, I want, you know, one thing that's been elusive in my recovery along the way has been gratitude, something that's so very important in that I've seen for me. And I remember our early meetings I went to, that was one topic that would always come up. And I used to think with contempt. I said, that was a cop out, you know. I couldn't think of anything else, huh? You know, gratitude, you know. And then I came to realize that the topics end up coming up in the amount and order of that they're supposed to, you know. And I really appreciate that today. But I still need reminders of what I'm grateful for sometimes, and or inspirations. And it's not enough for me just to imagine somebody less fortunate than me. You know, I've never really been comfortable with that. What inspires me is those that seem to have a bit more challenges and do more with their challenges in life. And that can be less fortunate in a number of ways, financially or whatever, but they go beyond that, you know, in their life, and they do more. And then I look at that and I go, who are you, you know, to, with all you have and the abilities and the clarity of mind that you have, to not be doing more with yours? And I want to share real quick here, if I can. I'm running out of time here, but it's a story. Maybe his name's Paul Anderson, and you might have heard him in the news recently. But Paul, this is a picture of Paul when he, just after he got his lawyers, he became a lawyer. You know, you can see he's a bit challenged, you know, and he's in one of those chairs, you know. And he died recently from COVID. He was 78. And he was also a painter, you know. And then you can see now that he's in an iron lung. 8 years old, he contracted polio. And for most of his 70 years, he was confined to an iron lung. And he did a lot. He was a lawyer. He came into the 21st century. He learned how to use things. He painted. He wrote books. He had a social media following, you know, where that plastic stick is working his cell phone or his computer, you know, to produce stuff. And it's all out of love, you know, the people that are around him, you know. And I think of recovery that way, you know, that it's, we're broken, you know, we're broken in so many ways when we get here, you know, and we've done so many things and to so many people. And this program gave me, you know, what the book refers to as a perfect release, you know, after I got here from all those things, to relax and to feel the spiritual nature of this and the love that's in the rooms. And no matter how broken we are, you know, we can find that love here. In 1991, when I got sober, I had very little in my IRA work. I'd worked there almost 10, 20 years and didn't have anything to show for it, you know. And so between then and 2000, you know, I'd contributed like a regular normal person. And then I was out of the market, you know, 2 weeks before the crash, you know, and escaped all of that. Well, many didn't, you know. And then in 2008, I was almost entirely out. But my arrogance had got a hold of me, and I got back in too soon, and it cost me about 15% of what I had at that time. But all that said and done, I was able to retire, you know, early, and take care of my wife at the time, who I thought was sick. Didn't quite turn out that way, and we didn't quite turn out as well as a result of that. And I mean, there's some, it's more of an involved story, but just wanted to mention that. In 2021, I certainly, after all my good decisions financially, I decided I was very, very good at time in the market and doing all this kind of stuff. And slowly but very surely, I developed an addiction to gambling. 2021, I declared myself a gambling addict, and I haven't placed a bet since February 12th of 2021. And I just say that, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I need to say that just to let everybody know that if there's anybody here that they have somebody to talk to, you know, that wants to talk about that at any time. It almost destroyed my life, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous in my system, in my experience, saved my life. Had I not had the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous before that and during that bottom that I had, I would not have known to listen to that quiet voice of right and reason that told me that there was a way out when everything else in my being was screaming and trying to drown it out, that I could make it one more time, or I could work my way out of this one more time. And I am forever grateful for that. I have a wife today in this program that I considered my most precious prize, if you will, of recovery. You know, I have a chance today to be a partner that I always wanted to be, but I never knew how to be, never knew it was possible, didn't even know it existed. And I continue to discover that each and every day. And I try to be that person that I wanted to be and make sure they know that. I started playing the flute in recovery, or it played me, I think. I think it found me, you know, because I started that just before Marguerite showed up in my life, and I'll hang on to that for the rest of my life, you know, that the flute brought her, you know, so there's this kind of, and I'm going to close, I know I've gone over, but I'm just going to close on this, and I just, you know, the things that are most important to me in recovery now are to seek, you know, that which either breaks my heart or swells my heart, you know. I mean, the things like a single woman with children, you know. I mean, that touches me so deeply, I can't tell you. A person trying to get a college education, you know, when maybe nobody else in their family had, or they come into recovery, you know, after a broken life, and then just decide to go back to school, and they're working to get a higher education. You know, those are things that break my heart. An alcoholic or a homeless person on the street with a tin can, I'm forever trying to figure out ways to bridge the gap between me and them. I mean, I still have a standoffishness, and I don't get something out of my pocket in time, you know. But I hear people who have solutions, you know, and I listen to how I might do that. Swelling my heart, you know, is a great example. It's just, you know, watching my children evolve, watching them, you know, in their careers, you know, that's a mixed bag, you know, because some of it's the, you know, emotional stuff from some of the damage, you know, getting over that or healing over that. That's both painful, but it's also, you know, when I see it happening and when I put my chin out there and invite them to take a swing at it, you know, in the interest of their own mental health. You know, or if they do, I welcome that, you know, and it swells my heart, you know, because I have a chance to give back. And then, of course, my grandchildren, you know, growing and evolving and being able to see them with a clear mind, you know, do what they do and become who they're becoming, you know. And it's just, none of this would have been possible without this program. And this program literally saved my life, and it continues to give me life. Well, thank you, everybody.